You know, an old blue tack gets all sort of weird and slimy.
That has never happened to me. I have no idea what you're talking about. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Flux.
And I'm Ben McKenzie.
Welcome to, well, not quite Pratt Chat, but like a tangential Pratt Chat, which is known as Ooka Club.
Yeah, it's still, I love this name. Actually, can I give you a quick bit of news that I found out recently?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, let's get on with the podcast.
No, please tell me the news. I must know the news now.
Well, every now and then I do a sweep and I look for new Pratchett podcasts, and I never expected I'm going to find that many. But the last time I did it, I found like three new ones, and two of them weren't even that, well, one of them wasn't even that new. It was like about a year old. I just hadn't found it before. Anyway, I found one brand new one that's just called Ook Podcast.
How dare they?
And it's Australian.
We'll have to fight them.
It's two Australians setting out to do a Discworld read through. There's also, as it turns out, a totally different podcast called Ook Podcast, which might explain why there's only one episode of this one.
But how dare they? Like, we are being greedy for names by having multiple names for our one podcast. Well, but
look, you know,
but they're in Australia, so we could feasibly fight them.
Well, it says they're in the United States, but I listened to the first episode and they are not. But they did their first episode back in April, and they're doing, you know, one episode per book. They haven't done another one, so I wonder if they'll be back. We'll see. I add them to my big list of Discworld podcasts.
I don't misconstrue. I think the more podcasts about this, the better. The conversations are important and ongoing. However, it is also important to point out that I have very severe only child syndrome and am extremely competitive, so how dare they?
Well, look, Liz.
How dare anyone?
I didn't know if I wanted to mention this on the podcast, but to make you feel better, as far as I can tell, at the moment, at least, we are the most popular Discworld podcast.
So we are our parents' favorite. Good.
Yeah, we are.
That's the main thing.
There's a couple others that are doing very well, and then there's kind of all the other ones. We'll talk more about podcasting this episode, so I won't go on too much about this now, but it's such a weird space. Like, if you have 100 regular listeners, you're already in the top 10% of all podcasts, you know? Like, there's so many. But it's also, even if you make a good one, you know, there's such a big space that getting heard is not easy. So, yeah, but we're doing all right. And that's down to you, subscribers and listeners. So,
and I have to confess, like, because I don't know, like, how all of the intricacies of podcasting works and how, like, all of that is. But the thing that I've found really nice, because I didn't know what to expect going into this, is that every month there's, like, we have a community. There's people whose names I recognize. Like, when questions come through, I know who they're from. I can remember their previous questions, and it's like an ongoing discussion. And that's been the nicest thing, I think. Like, that there is just an ongoing conversation between like a group of people, and people join and people take time off and stuff. But like, yeah, it's just, I didn't realize that that was something that could happen, or I guess didn't dare hope that that was something that could happen. And that's been really cool over this time.
Yeah.
Bit earnest early on for me, but yeah.
No, it's all right. It was probably worth mentioning we are doing this on a Saturday morning in a lockdown. So, you know, it's nice to have a reason to get high energy and talk about stuff.
Yeah, I'm not like an earnest person. It's just very cool, because like people come back and ask different questions and have things to say and things to chip in and are reading along, and that's just been very, very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel the same. I didn't know if it would go that way. I mean, my previous experience was doing the Doctor Who podcast. You know, I didn't know if that was lightning in a bottle in a way. Like, we had a really lovely community, but I didn't know if that was because we were doing such a big popular subject in a time when people were thinking about it, because it was for the 50th anniversary year and we did this monthly thing and it was live shows. So people who went to comedy in Melbourne came along. I mean, that feels like a whole other world now, right? But and it was a long time ago. It's 8 years ago now. But I didn't know if it would feel anything similar to that, or if people would get on board. And I think also we got a bit lucky. Like, I think we had the idea quite early on, and even though it took us a while to get going, by the time we were doing it, there was still only one other podcast doing it at the time.
Those charming Irish guys.
Yeah. And now there's like 10, which is kind of cool. Like, to see that diversity of voices and different people's opinions. And look, you know, I'm not going to talk too much about other Pratchett podcasts, because I have my own preferences, and I feel like it's a bit, I don't want to, you know, tell other people what they should and shouldn't listen to. I like some of them and I don't like other ones, but that's how it is with podcasts, right? And that's the beauty of it. Now there's 10 different ones. Maybe some people don't like us. Sorry, Liz. Maybe some people would like something to go along with us. And I don't want to trigger any of those only child anxieties.
It's okay. I'm all right with not being liked.
Yeah. It's nice that it's all going well. I mean, you know, and we could have ended up like one of those podcast zombies, a podcast that has an episode or two and then just sort of lingers around in the directories but never adds any more episodes. And yeah, like
alive but not alive.
Yeah, exactly. Like a zombie, you know?
It's funny you should mention zombies because I thought that we could talk a bit about them for this episode.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Hit me. What are you? I'm not a big zombie fan.
Well, isn't like you don't like the literal ideas of becoming a zombie or?
I definitely don't like that. I have been in a zombie film, a short zombie film.
Were you a zombie in it?
Actually, I've been in two and I was a zombie in one of them and I was a mortuary guy in the other one.
I have been watching iZombie, the Rob Thomas one, which is why I suggested this as a topic.
Is that the one about the
mortuary attendant?
Yeah. And she solves crimes with her zombie powers. I remember seeing the trailer for that and going, ooh, is this going to be the new Buffy kind of thing?
It is actually pretty amazing. And I think it has flown quite under the radar because it has a terrible name that doesn't really give credit to what the show is. And it's because it's based on a comic book that's also called iZombie. But it's not like iRobot. It's not like iPod.
Hang on. Yeah, I was going to say, is it iZombie as lowercase in iRobot or is it iZombie as in iPhone?
iPhone.
Oh, okay.
They also make jokes about the name, like sort of, in the show itself. And it's by Rob Thomas and Diane Ruggiero, right? Rob Thomas, who did Veronica Mars. And I have a theory that it's actually set in the same world as Veronica Mars because there's the same name of a college that isn't real. With similar like shop names and stuff.
Oh, I love
even
that.
Though Kristen Bell does exist as an individual in the iZombie world, but it's possible that Kristen Bell, the actress, would exist in the Veronica Mars world as well. So we don't know that for sure.
That's true.
No spoilers except for like this is episode one, pilot episode, all this information I'm going to give you. So basically there's a young doctor who's very keen. She's going to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. She decides to go to a party unexpectedly one night and people are taking designer drugs. She doesn't, but suddenly they all rage out. They're on a boat party and it's a massacre and they go sort of red-eyed and crazy. And she wakes up in a body bag craving brains. And she's like, what's going on? Her hair's turned white. She's really pale. And it sort of skips forward. She's become kind of a recluse. Her housemate's like, why have you broken up with your really nice fiance? All of this stuff. She's found a job in the morgue to get access to brains. And it turns out that she's totally normal, the same as she was before, like except that she looks a bit different. And if she eats small amounts of brains regularly enough, she won't turn into a full classic movie zombie.
Right.
So eating brains staves off that part of you. But she finds out that when she eats people's brains, she takes on parts of their personality and also gets flashes of what's happened to them. So she manages to start solving crimes with the police because they work in the police morgue by pretending she's a psychic. So it sort of takes off from there. And the really good thing about the show is that it has episode by episode crimes, at least for the first few seasons that they solve. And they also take the idea of like, what would happen if you had this zombie virus that you're totally normal, except you have to eat brains to its extreme end? Like what happens if it spreads? Like how would society deal with it? That kind of thing. So each season by season builds on that.
That's cool.
And it's also a complete show because they finished it, I think, when they wanted to finish it. So it ties off neatly.
That's good. That's always nice when they get to do that. That sounds cool. Is she actually undead, though? Or
so this is the thing they like tease out over the thing, because in the first episode, her boss in the morgue has figured out that she's a zombie because he used to work at the CDC. And he's sort of been like quietly like keeping an eye on the bodies and seeing that some brain has disappeared. And he's like, this is really exciting. Let's work on a study of it and let's try and find a cure. Oh, that's great. That kind of thing. Like he's into it straight away. And so she's got this ally and friend who's just so excited. And he's just so good. He's the highlight of the show. Yeah, so it's a virus. So they're sort of undead, but like they've got really low blood pressure. So they're not fully dead. And I was the same as you. I did not like the zombie genre at all because zombies are kind of gross. Like they're like dead bodies, like going around doing things and trying to eat brains. Like, and that's why I thought this show is so good because it kind of challenges zombie tropes without seeming like it's trying too hard, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they have their issues, but I have been known to enjoy a good police procedural. I'm kind of getting through the end of Brooklyn Nine-Nine and this sort of very interesting final season where they've gone, we can't really do, if I can use a word I've seen a few times, copaganda anymore. we have to acknowledge the issues in the system here. I'm halfway. There's only 8 episodes, and I've only seen the first 4. But it's a weird mix of, oh, this episode really tackles that stuff, and then this episode doesn't. But anyway, I'm getting off the topic there. But I really love, for example, Elementary.
Mm.
More for Holmes and Watson than anything else. But yeah, so I could get into this.
So good.
I reckon.
Yeah. And it's interesting because she basically has to take on different characters with each brain she eats because she's still herself and she still has to progress her storyline. But because she takes on characteristics of the murder victim each time, you get to see her do – it's kind of like Orphan Black in some ways.
Yeah,
as
I was
well.
Just thinking that. Yeah, yeah.
And it's fun. Like, it's just a fun show. It's so full of puns as well. Like, everything – like, her name is Liv Moore, like Olivia Moore. It's just so good.
Oh, God. That is outrageous. I love it. Okay. All right.
It's just brilliant. The actor I was talking about is Rahul Kohli. He's also in one of the Haunting of shows, like The Haunting of Bly Manor, I think is the one he's in. He's very good.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Those are really not my bag. I'm not a horror.
Oh, they're great.
Not a horror person, but that's cool. Okay. A zombie. Awesome.
Yeah, I would recommend it. So, yeah, I'm not really, I've seen zombie movies and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty good. Like, I like Train to Busan and, Shaun of the Dead and all of that. But it's usually the difference between them is kind of like the how would humans react in that situation is the main core. And then the zombies themselves are like, are they fast or are they slow? And that's all the characterization you get for a zombie. Whereas this one is a show about a zombie that's basically trying not to become the cliche of a zombie. That's why you have to eat brains. That's a different sort of take on it.
I like it. And it's got that kind of old school, like happens in the Discworld a couple of times, you can see the memories of the, the last thing the dead person saw kind of stuff, which sounds cool, but also not as easy a clue as that by the sound of it. All right. You sold me. I'm going to give it a go.
Yeah, it's fun.
I mean, I say that I am struggling to watch much TV at the moment because I'm also not a binger. This is the other thing that I've learned. Particularly in lockdown, I just don't like sitting and watching loads of episodes of TV at once. I think I rarely do more than 2 or maybe 3.
You're not someone who gets the, are you still watching this show message regularly? And I'm like, how dare you?
Very rarely. I mean, it has happened a couple of times. So I find that at the moment, I'm really only watching stuff that's coming out 1 episode a week.
Or like the newsreader?
It's
an Australian one. It's good.
Oh, yeah? Oh, well, I'd like to watch some more Australian stuff. Like, I haven't seen a lot of good Australian stuff come across my radar recently. I'd be keen to check that out. The newsreader?
I think it's called The Newsreader. It's on ABC. It's coming out week by week. I think next week might be the last episode. Okay. And it's set in the 80s and it's about a newsreader. But it's just, it's a really interesting look at a period of time in Australia because it covers like the Chamberlain case and that kind of thing. But it's not about that. That's like the news that's happening in the background of these characters in a particular newsroom's lives. So, yeah.
Okay. I can check that out. Yeah, no, I've been doing much sillier stuff. I've been watching Star Trek Lower Decks. Which is the comedy animated Star Trek show. I have been watching the Marvel shows and I'm kind of enjoying them.
See WandaVision?
Yeah, I watched WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier. I enjoyed those a lot.
It's funny hearing you say that you haven't watched much TV lately because I was like, oh, yeah, same. And then I was thinking and I was like, I've watched a lot of TV. I don't know how I've managed to fit it in. It feels like there's more hours of TV watching than I've had hours awake. So I don't know how that works. But yeah, and some of it's for work sometimes, like because there's a show that isn't out yet. And so I feel very fancy having seen it called New Gold Mountain, which is an Australian one. And it's set during the gold rush in the late 1850s. And it's from a Chinese perspective. And this is something I've always been interested in ever since I learned about how poorly treated the Chinese miners were. Oh, but yeah. It's also a great murder mystery as well in 4 parts. And so that's all the information I can say about it, but it's out next month and that's very exciting.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds like it's worth a watch.
And it has an epic cast and it's very well made. And yeah, it's very cool. It's nice to see Australian stories being celebrated.
Yeah. That's cool. That is,
we've got a lot of cultural cringe here, I think, with our own content.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame because, it's not like there's not talent here. It's just that we don't value it unless it goes somewhere else and is validated by someone else.
When I worked at a cinema in the box office, which is where I usually was, people would come and be like, oh, what's on in the next 2 hours? And I'd describe the films and they'd be like, oh, that one sounds great. What is it? More information. And I'd tell them. And then if you said it's Australian, they go, oh no, what else have you got? 7 times out of 10, if you mention that it's an Australian film, they weren't interested, even if they'd been interested up until that point.
Yeah.
So I used to avoid saying it at all, unless I was really pressed on what it was, which sucks. Yeah. Like, that shouldn't be a detractor. It should be neutral or attractor.
Yeah. One of the shows that we were talking about zombies, and it's not quite zombies, but I really enjoyed, as much as I thought it was a bit flawed, but I really enjoyed Glitch, the Australian show.
Oh, I've seen the first season of that.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I keep meaning to go back and watch the rest of it, because I've only seen the first season too. Yeah. What a weird show. And it feels so Australian because it's like set in this small Australian town out in the country. And it doesn't feel like other places. And
it's very cleverly done, but yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something too that you can tell. I think some people shy away from Australian films, particularly because they feel like, oh, they're all going to be really worthy stories about blah, 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 because that's a lot of the time that is what gets the funding, right? But you can tell other kinds of stories and other genres and still make them feel Australian. And that one was particularly, I think the thing I loved most about that is you had this sort of all these people coming back from the dead is the premise of the show. But they've all come back from the dead coming out of the local cemetery of this little town that's been there for like 150 years. And so there's people from different eras of Australian history with different stories. And you're like, this is awesome. Like, this is so weird and cool.
I'm going to go back and watch the next season because I had forgotten that show exists. And I loved the first season.
Yeah.
I was like waiting for it to come back. But it's like The Walking Dead's early seasons. I was like, I love this while I'm watching it. And then it ends and you're like, I'm cool to never watch this again.
Well, yeah, it's got a sort of central mystery. I think I started watching the second season and then I didn't get around to it. I forget why. And just a really great cast as well. It's so good. But this is the other thing, like in Australia, you can have a major role in a TV show like that. That's very cool. Does pretty well. And still, I was served pizza in a restaurant by one of the main actors from that show after it had been out. And I actually said, excuse me, were you in Glitch? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, you were really good. and it felt like I just felt compelled to say that because I'm like, I can see that you're having to work in a pizza restaurant right now. And this was like pre-pandemic, right? This is like 3 years ago or more. And I was like, but I get that because like I don't make a living off my creative work either. But yeah, I just want you to know you're really good.
Yeah. At the cinema I worked at, it was really trippy because like it was a really supportive place in terms of people who also had creative careers. So we had a lot of actors work there and would have people go off to do like a season of a very like big deal theater production. And then they'd come back and they'd be serving popcorn for like until their next thing. Yeah. Like it's hard to do. And also Miss Fisher's Murder Mystery is one of my favorite shows. So many people I worked with had like bit parts around the place. And yeah, it was just surreal sometimes. Like again, one time I was in the box office. There was 3 of us. It was a busy day. A guy came up to the front of the counter. I was in the middle and he looked at the guy to my left and goes, oh, were you in blah, blah, blah? And the guy's like, And then he looked at the guy to my right and was like, oh, and you were in blah. And he was like, yep. And he looked at me and I was like, no.
I wasn't in the things. Well, it's just, you know, we don't make enough stuff here. So, you know, I've done a tiny bit of TV. And when I say tiny, I mean like 2 or 3 things ever. And that's it. And I mean, it's not something I've pursued particularly, but even for really talented screen actors, there's just not enough work.
Mm.
You know, that's why they go to Hollywood, because they're making so much stuff there that even if you're always playing a guest role for 1 or 2 episodes, there's so much TV being made there. You'll find work. You'll do heaps. Yeah. I mean, not constantly. And there's plenty of people over there too who, you know, are working other jobs and stuff. But yeah, we just don't make a lot of particularly drama here.
It was just trippy because we'd show movies that like people on our staff were in, and it was just, yeah.
That's weird. Look, speaking of stuff we're in, one of the things I thought we could talk about today, Liz, because we don't talk about it much on the main podcast, is just what we've actually been doing work-wise, because you've got some big news that is recent as of this episode of the podcast, and I want to talk about it because I'm excited.
I'm shy about my, but
we don't have to talk about it for long.
Yeah, okay.
But I at least want to mention it and for you to explain what it means, because you have been longlisted for another prize. And I say another prize, Liz, because you are an award-winning writer. You have been nominated and won prizes before.
Yeah, but it just feels really awkward to say it.
Well, that's why I'm saying it, because I'm excited and I love this for you. This is so cool because you are very good. I don't know if I say this often enough, but I think I mentioned on a recent episode of the podcast, I finally subscribed to the Saturday paper because I realized it was one of the places I would be able to read your writing and it would make it a lot easier if I was a subscriber.
It's very kind of you. Thank you.
This is, now, is this an essay? Because I feel like I've read your writing on this topic because it's an essay you've written about what's been going on and still is going on in Hong Kong.
Mm.
But is this writing that's already been published or is it something that hasn't been published yet? I was a bit unclear about that.
Yep. So it's a new essay. I've written about Hong Kong before. So I wrote a piece for Kill Your Darlings about this is not a eulogy for Hong Kong, which was kind of when the national security law was first coming in and how I'd sort of emotionally reacted to that and also what it meant. And at that stage, it wasn't like they hadn't started doing all the court cases. They hadn't started shutting down the media. It was more like fear of what was to come. And in the sort of year since, like all of the sort of horrible predictions have started to come true. And it's really strange to watch from over here that going down and it not really being news. Like every so often a story will float to the surface. And of course, that's the case that there's news happening all over the world all the time. So many horrendous things. And it's been kind of a wake up call for me in terms of not just like what's happening in Hong Kong, but like this is, I guess, the first time this phenomenon has affected me. I'm like, the thing I care about, the Western world is kind of like indifferent towards it. Like, oh, that's just how Hong Kong is now. And there's no blame to be assigned. There's too much news for everyone to care about everything at the same time. Like, you can care about lots of things, but not everything can be the top story, especially during a pandemic. So it's been kind of hard watching journalists get arrested, elections cancelled, politicians forbidden from running because they're pro-democracy, and that just being a non-story in the country where I live. So the essay competition was around the theme of archive. And so I found that as a coping mechanism, I guess, in all of this time, I started sort of gathering stuff to do with Hong Kong because it was just something I could do. So like I ordered some slides that a friend sent to me from 1980s Hong Kong, and the essay sort of starts around those because it's like looking into a time that I wasn't even alive. It's a personal and political essay. It goes into what's happening there at the moment, how I've responded to it, and what sort of is next. Because it's difficult to feel feeble and like you can't do anything. And also the thing about national security law is that it's so vaguely worded that to even speak about it could theoretically be breaking the law, even if you're overseas. Mm. So like it's scary, which sounds horrible, to retweet news about Hong Kong. Because every time I do, I'm like, this is on my public record. I know I can't go back there now because people get arrested for less than, you can't talk about it there. And I've noticed like a loud silence about it. So I guess my motivation in writing this was to make the issue heard at least a little bit more. But it's also scary because it cements the fact that I can not go back because this is going out there with my name on it. And it's possibly a crime, which is, that's why the essay is called This Is Probably Sedition. And, I thought so many times about withdrawing it because it probably is sedition. Mm. And, but the point is like, that's what the law exists to do, to shut down conversation, to shut down discussion of it. So I'm not so arrogant to think that I'm going to make a huge difference or any difference with this essay. But I also feel that if you give in and just sort of don't talk about it because it's scary and because there's nebulous consequences, then it will just fade away even more. And yes, I guess you kind of have to talk about it if you care. And I've never really put something out in the world that really could have consequences for my future. Yeah, I think it's important and it's going to be published next year and I'm quite apprehensive about it. But I also think that if we don't talk about these things, then then that's worse. So, yeah.
Yeah. We might not feel like our single voice will make a difference, but you don't know which single voice is going to be the one that someone hears that means that now they know about this, you know, and that maybe they'll raise their voice too and will amplify it. So, you know, it's always better to do something than nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's that. But it's nice to have it recognized because it mean like being on Longlist means it's going to be published in an anthology. So
yeah,
so it's going to be out there. Yeah. But
And then it'll better be able to, yeah, do something.
Yeah. Mm. All right.
I mean, look, that's quite serious and earnest, but I thank you for discussing it because, I mean, look, I feel like just in case, listener, if you don't know what we're talking about, please look it up and read about what's happened in Hong Kong since the handover back to China and since the erosion of the independence of the region, because it was big news for not that long, like maybe a month or two.
Or less.
It felt, and it actually hasn't changed much.
Yeah, basically all of the dystopian stuff is happening. Like, they're shutting down the media, they're shutting down elections, they're arresting politicians, they're arresting journalists, people are fleeing to other countries, and
yeah,
that's just, yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of good work out there, and there's a lot of journalists doing really important work. Yeah. But let's talk about nicer things on a Saturday morning. And
sure, we could do that.
Yeah.
But still, congratulations.
Thank you.
As much as it might feel a bit weird to, you know, you're like a nominee, right? That's what a long list is. It's like the nominees.
Yeah.
And then the short list is like the nominees who will be announced at the awards. That's how I always think of it in my head anyway. But and it can feel weird when that sort of thing happens and it's about something that you didn't do for acclaim or fame or something. You did it because, you know, this was important. You wanted to write about it.
Mm.
But it's still an achievement. And I think it's worth celebrating that and mentioning it. So thanks for talking about it.
Thank you for asking about it. But I would like to talk about some nice news that I think should be celebrated because you have some. Plus, I'm also very curious because I don't know much about the, like, because it's always like something you're working on in the background or not in the background, but I would like to know more about the details. So,
yes,
you have a video game that you wrote for that is out now. It's always
was being re-released. This is the weird thing, right? Is that I worked on this game 4 years ago now. 3 years ago, no, 2018. And it came out originally in early 2019, but it was a PlayStation VR exclusive. So this is a thing a lot of platforms do. The company that runs the video game platform will give you some funding to make a game. But one of the conditions of that is that it is exclusively on their platform for at least some period of time. And that was the case with this game. So it's a VR game, a virtual reality game called Table of Tales, The Crooked Crown. And this is my first.
What a name.
It's a cool name, yeah. And I think Table of Tales was kind of already, was that already in there? I think I did have some little hand in the name. I didn't write that name, but I sort of helped us all figure it out what it was going to be. But my job was, I think my credit on the game is just narrative or story. I forget. But basically, I was the lead writer, and this was my first big, and still only really video game world, big writing job. I created the characters and I wrote the plot. They had like a basic framework of what it would be about. And then I sort of fleshed all that out and wrote the dialogue and most of the dialogue. I didn't write everything that's in the game. There's a few things that I didn't write. It's like a tabletop role-playing game. So it's like a Dungeons and Dragons-y style thing. And it is in VR. But the idea is that this table magically comes to life and all the little playing pieces are on the table. And one of the coolest things in the game that I did not write, this was kind of part of the pitch, was that all of the scenery and characters kind of come up out of the table. And this particular story is it's like a fantasy Caribbean kind of feel, but we tried to make it less colonialist. Yeah, which I thought a lot about actually writing the background for the thing. None of this is in the game because it's not really important, but the backstory is that it's this island in the middle of the sea and there's this little chain of islands there. And they call them the Crown Islands because they're kind of shaped like a little bit. If you squint a bit, it's like a big one. And then there's five little ones above it, which kind of looks like a crown with jewels set in it. And so the town on the main one's called Half Arch. And I forget what the big one is called. I think they just call it the Crown. And then the other islands are all named after gemstones. So there's the ruby, the emerald, the diamond, etc. Anyway, that's in the middle of the sea. And the idea was that it's kind of halfway between this fantasy world's equivalent of Europe and Africa. And two groups of humans came from those two cultures and kind of ended up there at the same time and have mingled together and made their own kind of separate culture there. And I think in the backstory I had like maybe there were some wars and stuff, but they settled down and now everyone just lives in harmony. And so the design of it is a little bit traditional fantasy medieval, but then with some other influences as well. So there's like some of the outfits that some of the characters wear are inspired by sort of West African fashions and stuff like that. And the artist on the game, Josh, did such an amazing job. It looks so cool. But yeah, the table comes to life and the fun of it is in VR. You can pick up the pieces and move them around, and you get to roll some dice like virtually and throw them on the table. You use your special powers by picking up cards in the VR and putting them on the character that you want to use them on. And now it's on Steam, which means you can get it on your Windows PC. And if you don't have VR, you can. There is a non-VR mode. Although I'm going to be honest with you, I think it's more fun in VR.
that sounds because like the table idea is like you pick things up. It's cool.
Yeah, and it's like it's a good. A few reviewers have said this, which is nice because I think this was part of our intention. Is that it's a good first VR game because it's a seated one. Like you don't have to stand up and move around. And for a lot of people, if you've ever tried VR and it feels a bit weird and uncomfortable. And I actually quite like VR, but I find if it's a moving around a lot game, I can't play for very long, like maybe half an hour. And then I've sort of like, oh, I've had enough of this for a while. But because this one, you sit down and you're just looking at the table. So it's just, you're able to freely look around at all the bits of the table and pick things up. It's a bit easier to get the hang of. I really found that writing for it was less like, because like a standard video game is a bit like writing for cinema or TV. Like it's a screen thing. You can cut away to things. You can do whatever you want, really, in terms of where you look and control the vision of the viewer. But VR is a bit more like theatre, like particularly if they're sitting down, they can look wherever they want. So we had to think of ways for how do we direct their attention to the important thing that's happening. And I just thought, because we had this table where everything was happening, I'm like, all right, well, let's think of that like the stage. And so we'll have movement over here when someone's speaking and we can do special. Can we do like, you know, spotlights? Can we do like special lighting effects and stuff? And the answer was, yeah, a bit. We can do a bit of that. And I think it works pretty well. And Clinton, who was the lead designer and producer on the game, did a really awesome job. Like it's a really fun, like if it was a board game, if it was a tabletop game, I think it would be really fun. Like you've got all these little different tactical options and you get to feel really cool. Like sometimes these games have a lot of constraints on when you're allowed to do things and what you're allowed to do, particularly if it's turn-based. But in this one, you've got a certain amount of points for actions and you just spend them however you want on the different powers. So you can combo things up. You can save points for later. You can do lots. You can do all kinds of stuff. And it's very flexible. So anyway, I was quite proud of it. I thought it was pretty good.
That sounds really fun.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's had some nice reviews, which is nice. So yeah.
I'm going to look into if we have VR. I'm so like not across what I all I know is that I've got an Xbox, but I only use it to play Mortal Kombat, but this sounds really cool and I want to play it because I've been veering away from VR, which I tried at someone's house one time because I know for a fact that I will become like viral video woman punches through TV screen.
Well, just, this is the beauty of the sitting down part, right?
Exactly. I was kind of like, oh, I'm not going to like fling something through my screen or like accidentally hurl a cat at something. It sounds like exactly my kind of reason that I'd want to use VR.
When it's safe to do so, you should come round to my place. I've got a VR set for the PlayStation precisely because I wanted to be able to play my own game. So, yeah, you can come and try it out.
No, I'd love to do that. And I will not punch through your TV screen.
I believe you. There's something I wanted to talk about this episode, and maybe I should just do this rant on my own, but I just feel like there were a few more things I wanted to say about Science of Discworld 2.
All right.
Is that all right?
It's okay.
I just need to get them off my chest because I feel like I didn't quite get there, and it was a difficult episode in some ways to get there and record, and particularly while listening back to the discussion, I realized a couple of things I didn't say. One was there's a bit I said at the start of that episode, Pratchett 47, just in case you're not listening to this in order. I felt like something they said in the book might explain some of the things I didn't like about the book. And they use the term philosophers, and they use it when they're talking about Newton. Newton kind of later in his life stopped doing science and went back to alchemy. And they said this is something that happens to a lot of scientists. They sort of get to a point where they feel like they've discovered enough about the universe that now they feel like, oh, I can solve the problems of the world. And I read that in the book. And at the time, I was just like, is that what Jack and Ian are doing in this book, where they're going, no, we can solve all the problems of the world if we just realize that stories are just stories and we can make better ones. That's kind of a hopeful story. But then there's also, and this was something that some of the subscribers brought up in our Discord, which I totally agreed with. And I was a bit disappointed with myself that I hadn't engaged with this. But the tone of the book when talking, particularly about religion and some of the aspects of it, it felt kind of mean. Like, they had their kind of, they had their bits where they sort of go, all religions are true for a given value of true. And if it bothers you that we're saying this, just pretend we're saying it about all the other religions. And I'm like, that doesn't really solve the problem. And it's certainly not Dawkins' level of let's shit on religious folks. But it is that same attitude of looking at the worst parts of religion, particularly organized religions, and then just going, and they're all like that, which is such a non-nuanced, non-scientific way of thinking about it, you know? Like, it's a universal. It's like, we know that's not how it works. It's like going, oh, yeah, well, this enzyme in humans does this. So clearly that's what it does in all creatures. And you're like, no, like, that's not. And it just felt, it came across a bit condescending in the science chapters. Did you feel this? I know I'm just sort of going off on my rant here because I feel like I didn't bring these things up.
No.
In the episode. But how did you feel about the tone of the science chapters?
No, like, it kind of, as in, like, reading the science chapters did not feel like reading a Terry Pratchett book. Like, there was, like, a different feeling to them. It felt as though Terry Pratchett, like, I'm sure he was across all of it. Like, it's not like they just put bits in his book without him knowing. But, like, it felt like he wrote the fiction chapters that tied in with it, and someone else, obviously, like, it was a very different voice. It didn't feel like reading a Terry Pratchett book for more than half the time on voice alone. And it did feel snarky. And I kind of, like, I didn't really know how, because I'd finished reading it that day, so I didn't really know how to process all of it. Like, I guess my summary is, I wish that we could strip all of the science out of it and just leave the fiction story, and I would have been much happier, because I found, like, in the science of the Science Disfraud 2, it either made me feel deeply stupid for not understanding, or that I was standing with the bullies laughing at someone else, and it sort of swung between those two things, plus a whole bunch of fun facts. And that might be a really harsh assessment of it. I really enjoyed the fiction side of it. But looking back now, the main things I remember are some fun facts, enjoying the story of it, but the feeling of being inadequately catered to, either, like, I don't know, like, it's just, and that could come back to me, like.
Well, I mean, no, for me, it kind of fails a bit as a science communication work. I thought the first one was a lot better. Like, it's still, because they were just trying to explain actual scientific concepts, which were not personified, like, they weren't about people. And because it kind of had, even though they did jump a bit back and forth throughout the book, it still had this sort of, we're just going to explain where did the world come from, basically, at different levels. It kind of made sense, and it didn't need to be an ongoing story. Whereas in this one, they felt like they had a real barrow to push. They're like, this is our idea. We think it's important. But they didn't structure it in a way that kind of led you into it easily, and it kind of jumped around the place. And, yeah, and it felt mean.
I think Atlanta had a really good point that I thought about quite a lot afterwards and during the episode, of that it wasn't signposted what was true and what wasn't, like, what was actual science and what was, like, going along with the narrative of the book and what was a metaphor or whatnot. And that's, I think, a big failure if it's a book that's supposed to be about science communication, because you will end up walking away being like, oh, yeah, this true thing, that's actually, like, their metaphor, and it's not true.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff about, you know, this is how stories shape us, it's like, well, there's not actually science that supports that. You know, some of it is speculative, and some of it is based on evolutionary psychology, and some of it has since been debunked, and a lot of the new stuff that they talk about. And if you haven't had a look at the show notes, I've tried to go through, and the things that we specifically mentioned in the podcast episode, I've gone through and had a look at that. But yeah, some of it's a bit not quite right. I don't know. It's just, yeah.
I like the Terry Pratchett-y bits. I like the Discworld parts of the Science Discworld. I didn't like the science bits in this one.
Yeah, and I was really disappointed by that, because I really liked the first one. Even the science-y bits I thought were pretty good in the first one. And I like, you know, I said this on the podcast, I really like their other science writing, but this one was a bit, yeah, I don't know.
Well, they can't all be bangers, I guess. But
yeah, I guess not.
I think there's also a thing, like, this is kind of, like, one of my personal things that I think about in book criticism as well. Often when you're reading something, if it's not speaking to you, you have to go through a process that takes a while, because you have to go, first of all, am I the intended audience? If not, then you have to factor that into your criticism, because just, like, if it's not written for you, doesn't mean it's a bad book. Whereas a lot of reviewers will fall into that trap of being like, oh, I'm not, like, the intended audience, then this book is crap. But at the same time, there's another thing of, like, if a book or an article is full of lofty ideas and impenetrable language, and I'm not saying that that's what this one is. This is more of a general statement about how to approach your view on a text. some writers will just like throw in a thesaurus worth of words because they can. And a lot of people will assume that it's their failing for not understanding rather than the writer's failing for not communicating.
Mm.
That's like two different things. Some people will slam a book because it's not written for them.
Mm.
And some reviewers will write something that's impenetrable. And then people reading it will be like, oh, well, like that person must be smarter than me. And the failing is with me.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Which is not the case. Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think who's their audience, right? It's Discworld fans who are interested in science. Mm. But then it doesn't feel... I don't feel like this is really about science. Like, this is about a particular thing that you want to talk about. And you're finding the science that supports it. That was my constant feeling.
And so, to jump off that as well, it's like, I think we are its intended audience.
Mm.
And again, not to be arrogant, like, if I felt like the science went over my head sometimes and also it was hard to follow... And that could be, like, how I was reading it. I don't know. But it just didn't feel like it pulled off what it was trying to do well.
Yeah. I agree. I think we did say some version of that in the podcast, but I just felt there were a few specific things. I don't know if I felt like I didn't want to be that mean about it or if it was just, you know, we were all pretty tired.
Yeah. But I also feel like Terry nailed his bits. Like, I feel like the fiction was a joy.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there and I did promise that I would. So
I did a mini TED talk about my views on literary criticism, which is actually, I could talk about that for 2 hours. Like, that was a very truncated version and I'm worried I didn't get my point across well. But yeah, it's, yeah. So, you have to look at where you're standing when you're either like looking at a review or a text. So, yeah.
That's good advice. I would like to hear that TED talk in full.
Maybe one day. It's not so fraught.
Liz, do you know what happened this week? This is totally off topic, but I just remembered. In fact, yesterday.
I do not know what happened this week. Well,
Rihanna Pratchett followed us on Twitter.
She what?
Rihanna Pratchett followed Pratchett Podcast on Twitter.
Ah, I better like not do any shit posting. Not that I was doing any shit posting before, but no. Yeah.
I don't know why, but there you go.
Right. Anyway, okay.
So we've got to watch.
That's very exciting. Well, it's not like we say nothing but nice things.
Well, it's true
because there's nothing but nice things to say.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I can't think of a good segue, so I'm just going to say the next thing I wanted to talk about.
You're going
to
cast across to a different topic?
That's pretty good. We had some great questions, and we will get onto specific listener questions, but Belle on Discord asked us to talk about what non-Pratchett podcasts we listen to, and I kind of talked about podcasts earlier, but I feel like this is a good just general thing for us to talk about, because I don't think we've talked a lot about podcasts before. Do you listen to podcasts?
I very artfully steered away from this question. Every time it's sort of come near me and I'm like, I just veered off. And this hopefully stays between us in the Ook Club.
Mm. I won't tell anyone.
I've never listened to a non-us podcast in full ever. I've listened to the occasional episode of a few here and there. Like, I've listened to some of Dr. Death and a bit of the Australian Financial Review's High Finance Crimes podcast. And that's not because I don't want to. There's like so many, I've got a long list of podcasts that sound amazing that I want to listen to and I've started to get into, but yeah. I haven't found the right way to weave it into my life. Cause like when I'm cooking, I generally put a TV show that I've watched previously on in the background and a lot of my other time like is watching either mindless television or reading. So I'm just trying to find like a good place in my life to slot it in. So yeah, that's a long roundabout bunch of excuses to be like, I haven't really listened to a lot of them, and it's not because I don't think they're good or because I don't want to. It's because I just haven't found the right way to work something else into my life.
That's fair enough. I'm sort of at the other end of the scale where I try to listen to too many podcasts and I've been making them for a long time. So I think about them way too much. So I think this is good. We balance out. But then I don't want to have this be a long one-sided list of podcasts that I listen to. But I do try to listen to a bunch of different stuff. And interestingly, I had a long list of favorite podcasts that I would always listen to. And recently I've kind of gone off a few of them. Not because they're bad now or I've found out something about the people who make them. It's not anything like that. It's just that I'm ready to listen to some new stuff instead. But long-running ones that I do still listen to, and this will probably not come as much of a surprise to you, listener, if you've ever read the show notes for Pratchett, because I often cite these things, but while it is one of the ones that I'm kind of gone off and I haven't regularly listened to for a while, I still do enjoy 99% Invisible, which is a long-running American podcast about design in all its forms. There's some really great episodes of that. I recommend going back and looking at the back catalog. I really love The Illusionist, which is Helen Zaltzman's podcast about language. That's still one that I try and listen to every time it comes out. It's great. I don't like true crime, but I did recently listen to a true crime podcast. I had such mixed feelings about it. I listened to the most recent season of Dr. Death. So there's a weird reason why I listened to season 3 of Dr. Death, because this is a famous podcast that started out with a story of one particular doctor, and I don't fully know. Do you? I think you've seen the TV series, right, Liz?
Yeah. So yeah, and that's why I went to go listen to the podcast.
And what's the deal with the doctor from the first one? Is he deliberately killing people, or is he incompetent? Oh,
that's the mystery of the whole thing. Like, is he maliciously incompetent or just incompetent? And right. So it kind of dives into that, because the things he does are so beyond belief that you're like, surely he has to be doing this on purpose. But then they dig into his history to be like, it could be either, maybe. But there are some conclusions. But wow. Yeah, the question is, like, is it malicious or is it just supreme arrogance that makes his incompetence continue?
Yeah, wow.
He does some truly horrific stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the trailer for the TV show, and it's like, that kind of medical thing is not usually my bag. And I, like I said, really, I'm not a true crime person. But the reason I listened to season 3 of Dr. Death, which only just came out, is because it's about a story that literally happened to a friend of my mum's.
Right.
And my mum is... They sent her a microphone so they could interview her for the podcast. Ah. So my mum is in season 3 of Dr. Death. But the disappointing thing is I listened to all 6 episodes and she's hardly in it. Like, they used pretty much nothing that she said. They use one thing that she says in the trailer and in one of the early episodes because it was a good line. And that was it. And basically, it's about a doctor who was working in Sweden, and he's supposedly doing this amazing breakthrough, cutting-edge research, doing implants of artificial tracheas. But it was all fucked, if I can put it that way. But also, he's one of those people who's like a serial liar. And the thing that happened to my mum's friend was not medical. She was doing a news story about him before anyone knew that he was terrible. And then he kind of propositioned her and they had this romance. And he told these incredible... I don't want to say too much, because if you listen to it, you probably... Like, he's a Baron Munchausen level liar. Like, it was incredible. Mm. And I remember my mum telling me some of the secret stuff that he was telling her at the time when they all believed it, because it was so outrageous that they're like, why would you say that if it wasn't true? Like, it was that kind of thing. And people have been very mean to Benita, who's the person in the story. Everyone's always mean to people who are taken in by scams until they get scammed. Like, I'm going to be honest, I don't particularly like the way it's told on the Dr. Death podcast. It's very bombastic and over the top. I don't know if the first season's like this, but it's always like, what could possibly be happening? And just really telling you every single emotion. And you're like, this is a bit full on. But I hadn't heard a lot of the medical side of it before, because that hadn't been part of the previous versions of the story that I've heard. And I found that really interesting. So, yeah, it was disappointing. But anyway, so that was my brief foray into true crime. But I do like a good crafted documentary podcast, and I kind of listen to lots of different stuff. This is one that might appeal to Discworld fans, actually. So, listener, this might be one for you. I recently finally got around to listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast.
The what?
The Beef and Dairy Network podcast. This is an English podcast made by one guy, Benjamin... Oh, I forgot his surname.
Is it McKenzie?
It's presented as the podcast of the Beef and Dairy Network, which is like an industry network for beef and dairy farmers. And it's not. It's fictional and it's very silly. I started listening to it probably about 3 or 4 months ago, and I've mainlined it. There's quite a bit of it because it's been running for a fair few years, but not so much that it's like daunting. And if you want to try it out, the first episode is a really good taster. It gets a lot weirder than the first episode, but the first episode's really short. It's like 12 minutes. So if you listen to that, you'll get a real feel for what it's like. And I researched this because I was fascinated. I really wanted to know how it was written. And I think it's written kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm style. If you're not familiar with that, it means that they don't write a full script. They write like notes for the characters. Like, they put down a few facts and a few things that they want to happen, but then they let the performers pretty much improvise around that. I think some of the stuff would have to be scripted, but a lot of it is that. And they've used stuff that's come up in that improvisation to just continually build out this more and more unhinged world in which beef is like the most important thing in the world. It's a very weird podcast for a vegetarian to be listening to in the first place, to be honest, but it is very funny. It occasionally gets a bit gross, as in gross out humor. He's pretty good at telling you when it's particularly gross. Like, there's one episode where he says, just so you know, this episode will contain a lot of vomiting. And you're like, oh, that's good. I'm glad you let me know. It won't be for everyone, but it is very silly. And most of the time, it's great.
That sounds amazing.
It's a lot of fun. So that's a big one that I've been listening to. And there's so many others. I've done a lot of looking at scripted comedy podcasts for the subject that I teach, which is writing comedy for audio at the Australian College of the Arts. And so, yeah, I've looked at quite a few, including the Fitzroy Diaries. It's a local Australian one. Oblivity. This is like a sci-fi sitcom from the UK. That's a lot of fun. I like that one. The Parable of Crossbred, Australian mockumentary comedy podcast. Very fun. A quote-unquote Christian hip-hop band, but they're not really a Christian hip-hop band. And the story of their rise to fame and fall, that's pretty funny. And it's got some great music in it too, actually. Oh, there's a new season of the Bodgy Creek Community Podcast. This is a local podcast made by Damien Callinan, a Melbourne-based comedian and actor. He made a film called The Merger, which is great. If you haven't seen it, recommend it. And this is set in the same world. So this was originally the pitch for this was the Bodgy Creek Football Club podcast. That was the first season. And he made it around the release of the film because the film's about a small fictional Australian country town called Bodgy Creek, whose football team is going to be forced to merge with another local football team. And they don't want that to happen. And the only way they can avoid it is if they get new players. And so Damien Callinan's character gets all of these refugees who've been settled there to come and be on the team and try and integrate them into the team and get the town to accept them. And it's a beautiful story. It's really funny. It's really smart, funny, and it's quite heartwarming as well. I really recommend the film. Anyway, so he made this podcast about the football club hosted by his character, Troy Carrington, from the film. And then that kind of transmogrified during the first big lockdown last year into the Bodgy Creek Community Podcast, which kind of, I think, started with his idea to do a joke about a podcast that's job was just to tell you all the things that had been cancelled. yeah, he did a whole season of it. Full disclosure, I did do a guest thing for it where I made a little mini episode of Night Terrace where my character from Night Terrace visited Bodgy Creek. So that's in one of the later episodes of the first season. But I'm very excited because now there's a second season. And it's just a delightful little collection. It's mostly Damien playing all the different characters. And a bit like Beef and Dairy Network, he's building out this world as he goes of just this bizarre little Australian country town where nonsense happens. And it's so much fun. I did not expect to like it as much as I did, but I really did. And I'm excited that he's doing a second season. I think, you know, he's... like the rest of us, I think we're all reaching the stage of this current lockdown where we're like, oh, this is going to be a long one. Okay, well, I guess I'll do something to occupy my time. So, yeah, I recommend that. It's very cute.
And I do want to clarify, I have listened to episodes of quite a few podcasts, but I've never listened to a podcast in full is what I meant earlier. So,
oh, you mean like every episode of a podcast?
Or more than like a handful.
Okay.
Except for one where I listened to all the episodes that were available at the time that I listened, which means nothing. Like if there was one episode available at the time, but I've listened to quite a lot of the Bird's Eye View podcast. It's a documentary one that is all within a women's prison and it's produced sort of by the prisoners as well as a podcast producer. I listened to it because I was originally doing an article about it, but it's really good. Like it's very illuminating. It's horrifying in some ways because you learn a lot about the reality of life inside a prison and also the reality of what happens when you get out and how little support there is available. And also like the things like prison jobs where they end up, there was one episode where they were assembling headphones for, I think, Qantas or something for flights and they're paid such a low amount. It's just, but it's actually quite upbeat as well because it's done, it's own voices. It's the prisoners putting together what they want to, well, I shouldn't call them prisoners. Like it's like the women who are incarcerated talking about their stories, telling us about their lives, both inside on and on the outside. And I think it's very valuable. To listen to. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Look, I'm not going to talk as much about other podcasts, but I feel like I do want to mention a few other ones that I've listened to. Oh, my friend Lucas's podcast, Episodes of Death, which is a Doctor Who podcast where he gets people on. This is another one I've been on, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. He gets people to come on and defend some of the worst ever Doctor Who stories, ones that the general fan consensus is they're not very good, but But we go on there and we say, no, it is good. Previous guest Dan Golding still has his podcast, Art of the Score, which if you're really into film and TV soundtracks is really good. I have a mixed relationship with some of the big D&D podcasts. So these are games of Dungeons and Dragons or other role-playing games where people on the podcast play the game and sort of tell the story and then they edit it and release it as a podcast so you can listen along. I prefer the ones that are made specifically as podcasts rather than the ones that are live stream video that then gets released also as a podcast. But I am an old school Adventure Zone fan. I'm a bit behind on the Adventure Zone, but that's a good fun one. And the local Sydney one, Dragon Friends, I am up and down on, but I stick with it because I really love Dave, the DM. But I will say the humor is very juvenile and stupid. There's one that I should mention because we've both been on it is the Morning Bell podcast by also previous guest Joel Martin, which is a writer's podcast. And I think this one is also on hiatus, but there's so many good previous episodes just talking to different writers from different disciplines about their process. Also, shout out to Lisa Dim, who does a podcast, which is just watching and discussing all of the films and TV shows that Jeffrey Combs or Combs. I realized when I was a guest on this too, and I realized I don't know how to pronounce his name properly, but she's just watching all of that stuff. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. I went on to talk about the episode of Babylon 5 that he did because he's in one. Yeah, there's heaps. Look, we should get onto at least a few of the specific listener questions that we've been sent. And we probably won't get through all the ones we've got banked up today, but we'll try and do another Oot Club before too long. I don't know if it's harder to make Oot Clubs when we're in lockdown or easier. I feel like sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. I don't know.
Yeah, it's all things are like that during lockdown. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's harder.
Anyway, I hope that we will make another one before too long because I know it's been a while since the last one. Been probably like nearly 6 months, so we'll try and
feels like we just did one. I just don't know how, like, where the time goes.
I know, but yeah, we'll try and do another one soon, so we'll get to a couple more of these questions. But also, if you have a question for us for Oot Club, please send it in. You can ask us anything you like, you know, within the bounds of human decency and niceness. It can be general stuff that's Terry Pratchett related, which we'll preference, but you can also ask us about reading stuff, listening to stuff,
zombies.
Cool questions that you think would be fun for us to talk about. Because our original plan for this podcast, we were just going to do a fun activity and then answer some questions. We kind of dropped the fun activity because we ran out.
There's only so many times I can fail at a Discworld quiz, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I do have a cunning plan, but it's going to take a bit of plotting to make happen. And we will, at some point, we'll get to that. We did ask what characters you want us to do an in-character episode in, and we have thought about that. We're not doing it today. We'll try and make it happen. Don't worry.
Oh, yeah, it's going to happen, and I'll be terrible at acting, but we'll see.
Well, that won't be the point, I don't think. Liz, do you want to pick out some questions for us?
Let's have a look. All right, how about we go with this one from Graham Kidd, which came in via Twitter. How do you decide what book is next? How are deadlocks negotiated, and do the Pratt Cats get a vote or two? That's a very good question. They're all very good questions.
That is a good question. Well, how do we decide this? I think we kind of just chat about it, really, don't we?
Yeah, we have a Pratt chat about it. I think the scaffolding of it is that there's only so many Discworld books and we don't want to finish them all at the beginning and then do all the non-Discworld books at the end. So we kind of do it roughly chronological, but if there's a compelling reason or we just want to do something a bit different, we'll move we'll bump one up. So, like, that's why we've done Going Postal already, but we're roughly moving chronologically with the Discworld books spread out across our schedule and non-Discworld ones scattered in between.
Yeah.
So, it's just kind of, we do take a step back and have a look what would work well next to each other as well, because you don't want to have three very samey ones in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's a scaffolding, a Discworld scaffolding, and then we just see what fits in around that naturally.
Yeah. And it's particularly important as we go into the planning phase for the next year or possibly two as we get to the end, because, you know, there's only, I think I mentioned this, we're down to the last dozen actual Discworld novels now.
Mm.
So, if we just did those, we'd be done in a year, but we're not going to just do those. We've still got to do all these other books and we want to start doing more of the short stories, and we've said we're going to try and do some of the TV stuff as well.
Hmm.
We just chat about it, really, is the process. We don't need to vote. There's only two of us.
Yeah, there's not really any deadlocks because we don't sort of have strong views, or if you do, there's usually a good argument so the other person doesn't disagree. Like when Ben wanted to do the time difference between Color of Magic and Light Fantastic based on the actual release, like that was solid to me. So I was like, yeah, well, let's lock that in.
I mean, I don't know if I would back that up now, but I'm kind of glad we did for the lols. I think the other thing that's been nice is that because there's a couple of specific things that I've had in mind, most of which I've discussed with you. I think there's probably one or two that just haven't come up yet, so I haven't said them, but where the juxtaposition is nice. Like, it's good to read something from his early writing next to something from his later writing. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why it was nice we did Dodger quite early on.
Yeah.
Because we're reading all this early Discworld stuff, and then we're reading something quite near the end of his writing career, and it's like, yeah. I do want us to cover part two of Graham's question.
Oh, about Pratt cats getting a vote?
No.
I was going to say, yes. But I do have something to say about that, yes. Which is I have more cats. So if we do ever get to a deadlock, I will win.
You control a bigger block. It's true.
Yeah. If you can easily address this by getting more cats. But yeah.
I have thought about it because I have wondered if Chaos would like, he does this thing where he gets very aggressively playful late at night and he'll like attack us. And I wonder if he just wants another cat to play with.
I'm significantly less injured than when I just had one cat because they sort of chase each other around and sort of like get their like cat-like energy. Like, because they don't injure each other. They just sort of run around and scream a little bit from time to time, not all the time. But like, I used to play with Asimov and they don't mean it. This is what like you like cat owners are always like, oh, I'm covered in scratches, but they don't mean it. But I used to get covered in scratches and I can't remember the last time I got one actually now. Like, my legs were a carnage. But yeah, I've just got beautiful unscratched skin now that the cats can just have their social running around.
Yeah, okay. I mean, he doesn't like other cats, so I've been thinking it would have to be a kitten so that he felt like he was the boss.
He'll probably hiss at it for a while as well. There's ways. If you get another cat, I've got advice for you. So yeah.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Because then I could level out
takes a while.
The voting. Because Toby doesn't get a vote. How dragging.
It seems a bit unfair, doesn't it?
Well, actually? I mean, it's mostly because he can't speak. Or make
plus,
noises.
He's just kind of like a puppet for your opinions, isn't he?
Yeah, more or less. And I feel like that's inappropriate. That's sort of the magical nature of our relationship. He's kind of like a familiar, so he kind of has to do what I tell him. And I always feel uncomfortable about it too. And I feel like in a voting situation, it's very unfair. But no, there was a follow-up from Graham, though, is the other question that I
And I can see you're itching to answer it. So all right, so how do you track what is done and upcoming? Is there an amazing PrattChat spreadsheet? If so, is it color-coded? Ben, would you like to take this one?
There are two amazing PrattChat codes. I mean, look, I can't say that
they're amazing. No, they're amazing. I can say they're amazing. I didn't make them.
But the other thing is, they weren't color-coded until relatively recently. And in fact, when I saw this question come up on Twitter, Graham, it was literally the day after or the same day that I had color-coded the spreadsheet.
I did not know that. That is amazing. That's some serendipity right there.
Because I just thought, well, we've done so many episodes now. I want to kind of see at a glance how we've spaced them out. So the spreadsheet's got a lot of tabs. It's a Google Sheet. Maybe, you know what? You're a subscriber if you're listening to this. If you want to see it, let me know because
it's beautiful.
There's, I might do a version of it that you can see. I'll take out some of the forward planning that's very speculative. At the moment, it's got dates in it all the way to the end of, can I say this, Liz?
Yes, you can say it.
At the moment, it's got speculative dates in it all the way through to the end of 2024. I don't know that we'll be still running. We'll find out. But we've got a definite plan up to the end of this year. And I've done a bit of forward planning that Liz and I haven't talked about yet. This is all just speculation where I was like, well, I'll just put some stuff on there and we can talk about it. But I've kind of tried to space out the Discworld books like we were just talking about. But anyway, because we'd had like, you know, nearly 50 episodes and we will have by the end of the year, I was like, well, I'll just color code them. So I've got like green for the Discworld ones, orange for standalone books. And then different colors for the other series. So I've got like blue for the Bromeliad and pinky sort of purpley color. Nice lilac, I guess, for seems appropriate for the Oog Club. yellow for the Johnny books. So there's little colored bands in there so I can kind of look at it at a glance. But it's also got a list of all the books. And this is the interesting thing is there's some disagreement about how many there are. Well, obviously, there's 41 Discworld novels. The usual number is 60 novels all up. Right, which would be 60 episodes for us, but obviously we're going to have more than 60. And I've got, I think, 81 books in the list, not all of which we do as an individual episode. Some of those are like collections of short stories and stuff. And that includes stuff that's not novels as well, which we'll start covering eventually. But that sheet has been coded for a bit longer. Like, we color it in green when we've done a book, so we can see which ones we've done and haven't done pretty easily. I do have a list of all the short fiction that's easily accessible, most of which was published in a blink of the screen. And then we also got stuff like we've got a list of possible guests, people we'd like to get in, or people we've discovered are Pratchett fans who might be...
Yeah, if you say that you like Terry Pratchett on the internet at some point, just scroll it away on our spreadsheet.
Yeah, so. We'll find you. So, that's the main spreadsheet. I also have a totally separate one for managing all of our stuff around possible subscriptions. So, for you.
So, how about we move on to another question? Question and a comment here from Elizabeth, which came in via email. Elizabeth gave some really great context to this one, but I'm just going to pull the question out. So, what character has changed most for you upon rereads? It's a tough one. It's a good one.
I mean, the obvious answer would be Rincewind.
Mm. Oh, you took mine. Damn it.
Well, I mean, I think that's the obvious one, though, Liz. I think that's what most people would say.
Yeah.
But particularly because having just read Signs of Discord 2, where I really like where he's gone with Rincewind's character, I think for me it'll be really interesting when we get to Unseen Academicals and seeing him more in his usual context and thinking, oh, is he still cool and interesting now, or what's happened to him? But I think he's the obvious one.
Here's a strange one to throw in the mix. Dibbler.
Oh,
he's stayed consistent in terms of, like, he's funny. He's always the first one in to make the most out of a terrible situation and all of that. But I think the older I get, the more I read over it, the more backstory I, like, in my own head give him. And so, like, and try to sort of, like, understand why he is the way he is.
Yeah.
Whereas previously I used to just enjoy him as, like, a bit of a shyster out to make a buck all the time. He's just one that every time he comes up, I'm like, but what's your backstory? Like, why have you turned out this way at all? And, like, seeing him have that equivalent in one of the books and seeing him, like, do really well in Hollywood and have that all, like, taken away from him. Like, it's just, you know, like, he's less two-dimensional for me. Like, he used to be two-dimensional comic relief.
Yeah.
And he still is. But I think I just keep trying to add my own third dimension to him because I just want to know more. Like, I want a Dibbler book.
That's
or really a backstory or something. So, yeah, that's perhaps not quite addressing the question in the way it was intended, but he is one that has changed for me in terms of how I want to relate to it.
Mm. That's really interesting. I would not have thought of Dibbler that way. That's cool. I think for me it's like two of the Watch. I feel differently about Carrot now than when I was reading Carrot as a teenager. Because when I was reading Carrot as a teenager, I was just like a heroic dude who's nice to everyone, who's destined to be the king and turns it down, and he's got red hair. This is cool. Whereas now I read it and I'm like, oh, you're like one bad choice away from becoming like a despot. Like, this is like, you are working hard not to be the thing that you have realized you could be. And I think I didn't pick up on the nuances of stuff where Vimes is always going, how much does he know what he's doing? And I think that undercurrent of the character became a lot more clear to me on a reread as an older person. As an adult. I'm not that old. But the other one is Cheery, who I think a lot of the gender politics around Cheery, I understand a lot better now. I was one of those people who thought I understood feminism until I confronted the ways in which I had internalized misogyny and been a terrible, typical man. And then I was like, oh, I didn't get it at all. And I think rereading Cheery now in the light of that, but also in wider context of understanding issues around trans folks better and seeing how that fits in and how much that resonates with people. Yeah, I really see Cheery in a different light. And I think, I always liked Cheery, but I like her even more now.
Now, reflecting on it, one character that changed a lot for me on reread was William DeWord in The Truth. So, the first time I read it, I was like, hey, here's this scrappy guy out on his own, just doing some good journalism and breaking free of his family ties and just trying to work towards the greater good, which I still think is the case. But I think the first time I read it, the nuances of his privilege and his background and getting things a little bit wrong and the way he, like, handles things didn't come across, because I was, like, I guess the first time I read it, I was very, like, books have a hero and a villain, and there isn't an in-between. Like, I hadn't got to that stage of reading yet, and he's written as neither. He's mostly good, but he has flaws. And I think the first time I read it, my mind just sort of sandpapered them off to make him fit what I expected him to be like. And he's a much more interesting character. And I still think, like, because he has to work against a lot of internalized stuff. I mean, that makes him more impressive, I think.
Yeah.
But his journey looks different to me now on reread.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's an interesting one because it was one of the books that I enjoyed the most originally. But, yeah, coming back to it, I was like, oh, I've got a different read on him. Like, I still feel overall the same. But, yeah, just seeing how he starts to how he ends up, the journey's different, like I said.
Yeah. When I read it, even though I hadn't read it before, I think one of the things that ties into that is how modern the way that Pratchett discusses the idea of privilege in that book is. It feels like something that could be written now.
Mm.
Yeah.
Have you got any other characters, or should we move on to the next part of Elizabeth Emails?
Look, I can't. I think for me, there's a more general thing, which isn't about a specific character, but the other characters that have a real edge to them, I think I understand the edge and find it a bit more frightening now as an adult, like particularly the witches. When Granny skirts towards evil, I find that a lot more frightening now rather than when I was a teenager and I read it and I was like, oh, yeah, she's badass. Whereas now I'm like, oh, no. Yeah, so I think there's a bit of that. But that's more general thing for a lot of the characters that have that kind of edge. Like, Vimes a bit as well. And I'll be interested to see, because as we get to the sort of last few Vimes books, I'll be interested to see what I think of those too.
I think it comes back to the thing of, like, a lot of literature and film and television for children shows that people are inherently good or inherently bad, whereas these books, and I'd argue real life, it's about no one's either, really. You're constantly choosing whether to be good or bad.
Yeah.
Like, it's not so binary as that, but, like, I think the frightening thing about Granny is powerful and could control the whole world if she wanted to. She's choosing not to because it's the wrong thing to do if she did that. And I think the fact that it's a choice isn't something that is sold to young children or teenagers, even in the not all, but in a lot of the most mainstream texts, like Disney, for example, is not going to say you're choosing to do the right thing. It's you are good and therefore you will always do the right thing. It's not a choice.
Yeah, which is, I think, kind of a damaging oversimplification.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it comes back to that. Like, I think I've talked about that previously, but yeah, choice.
Yeah.
So the second part of Elizabeth's email is about the word hex. And this just points out that it sounds exactly like the Dutch word for witch. So did Terry know this and was it intentional? And again, there's a lot of great context around this, but I feel like he's so into language that he might have known that.
I think, well, it's definitely a pun, right? Because the reason he's used that word is that hex is short for hexadecimal, which is a very common encoding of numbers used in computing. So it's where you take your binary numbers and you sort of squish them down so that you have a base 16 number system, but that's compatible with a binary system because 2 raised to fourth power is 16. So I made that more complicated an explanation than it needed to be. But anyway, hexadecimal is the thing in computers, and a hex is a horrible, evil bit of magic, even in English. So I think that's the pun. And I'm sure he did know hex or hexen or hexa is a word in a lot of European languages that means witch. I think actually in The Witcher, the series, I think the Polish word for witcher is hexen or hexer or something like that.
Well, there's a book I was reading. I think hexer is possibly German for witch as well, because I was reading a book that starts off set in Prussia in the 1800s in a small village, and they refer to a woman as a hexer, meaning witch. And I think they spoke German. Yeah, like you say, in a lot of European languages.
Yeah. I don't know if it was specifically the Dutch word that he was thinking of.
I do think it was intentional, and I love that Elizabeth has brought us this point, though, because, like, we haven't really gone into Hex's name or even, like, really talked much about Hex separately, like, because there's never really time in a podcast to sort of, like, focus in.
Like, because I, having a computer science background, there's a lot of little jokes that, and I think I've mentioned a couple of them, but there's a lot of little jokes in there that are like, that's quite specific to computer technology of the 1990s.
I didn't know you had a computer science background.
Yeah, I studied computer science at university.
It's so weird because I nearly did as well. That was like what I originally got into.
There you go. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, that's so trippy.
We're both big nerds together.
I even went to initiation and stuff, like to start like picking out my schedule and things. I was going to do a double degree of law and computer science. And the guy was like, yeah, you can do like forensic accounting for the police. I was like, that sounds like a job. But it also did sound kind of cool. Like, it was around the CSI time when, like, everyone was, like, really into all really niche areas of, really cool.
Yeah.
So close.
I mean, I studied it, and I didn't finish a degree in it, but I did work in computers, mostly in support, but then also like database administration and analysis.
That's why the spreadsheet's so good.
Well, I spreadsheet okay. Like, I feel like my spreadsheet game is adequate because I have seen some of the world's greatest spreadsheets.
That should be an exhibition, actually, like an interactive exhibition, like the world's greatest spreadsheet. And you can go and see like how it works when you put in different like data points and things.
I have a particular friend who the things she can do with a Google Sheet will blow your mind.
Right, well, now I must see. So
I can't show you most of them because they're all for like behind the scenes stuff on festivals and things. But I'll have to find out if she's ever done anything more public that you can use. I've got a few more questions banked up, but I think maybe we'll save them for the next one because this has been a delightful conversation, but it is a longer episode for the Oot Club. We don't usually go this long. So this has been
nice. This is usually a full episode length.
Yeah.
Episode.
It is. I mean, I'll cut some of it out, so it'll be shorter, but that's all right. That's my job. I did want to throw in a couple of things because for time, I had to cut a couple of things out of our discussion of the Long War. And in particular, there are a couple of answers to some really good questions that we got that I wanted to put the longer answer in here because I thought there was some really good discussion there. Let me just... One of the other things in this spreadsheet is a list of all of the bits that I have chopped out as outtakes with a little description. Mm-hmm. For example, this one's just labeled the depressed cat and the penguin, the post office, the early years, the grim teacup. I think I know what that one's about, but out of context, it's quite good.
Yeah.
Some of them are about things that we get wrong. Can I read one out about you, Liz? It's only 11 seconds.
Absolutely.
Liz forgets about the third major crime in the book. That's just, I've got a note there. Some of these things keep, and I don't know why. I'm like, I'm never going to use those. Ben is ashamed and then lauded for his own Magnum joke. I mean.
Do I want to hear that or do I want to just live in the joy of the summary?
I don't think we need to hear those things. Anyway, those are a few. I have to amuse myself somehow in the long hours of editing, which are quite annoying sometimes.
The third crime. It sounds like an Agatha Christie spoof.
It does a bit.
Yeah.
But there's two questions, I think. Belle asked a great question. Hello, Belle. I know you're listening. It was about what would you take with you if you were going to the Long Earth? And we got into a bit of an extended discussion about what we might take or why we might go.
I mean, I'm not going to take the Encyclopedia Britannica with me. That would be quite inconvenient, but you also can't bring a USB. So I guess like the Oxford Book of all of history.
What? I think you can bring a USB. Like you just can't bring
iron. What are you going to plug it into?
You can. Well, they have computers and stuff.
Okay, true.
Yeah, if you can bring technology, then I feel like I'd bring something with access to Wikipedia and then I've done my bit for humanity, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because remember, there's at one point where they're trialing those new startup kits for new colonies, which have a whole bunch of stuff in them, including, like, here's a copy of essentially, like, Wikipedia and, like, a whole book on how to build stuff and, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess, like, just, like, everyone, you'd bring a few sentimental objects, so I just choose like maybe like a very wearable or portable amount of things that represent different things from my life. So like the first one that comes to mind, it wouldn't be the only one, would be a necklace that my grandma left to me when she died. She left me her jewelry box and she left it locked very mysteriously. So no one could open it until I got it. And in it is a necklace that my grandfather brought back from Egypt during the war for her because they'd been separated for that whole time. So that's kind of nice. And I think. Yeah.
Wow.
Liz, your answers to this question are so good. Can we just like, everything you say is just like more profound than the last. So, like, this is the answer I wanted to give and I couldn't think of anything.
I just have too much sentimental attachment to things. So I've thought about this a lot. I'm like, okay, if I had to like cut down to the bare essentials, what would I bring?
This is just making me realize I have a much lower amount of sentimental attachment to a lot more things. Which is stupid. Like, none of them are like, if I could only take one thing, it'd be that thing. Mm. But there's lots of them that are like, but I don't really want to leave behind my dice.
I would have a lot of sadness about things I couldn't bring that I would probably carry with me for the rest of my life. Okay. But I'm just trying to be like, I wish I had brought that and that. But I was like, okay, if I had to bring a handful of tokens.
We should say Belle did give her own answer to this question, which was to say she'd take the teddy bear her grandparents gave her when she was born. And I have one of those teddy bears too, actually. That might be something I'd take. My mum made me a teddy bear before I was born. He's blue and I still have him and he's still intact and he lives in my room and he probably could come with me, but I'd be scared for him. So maybe I'd leave him at home. Mm. But I don't think I would go to permanently live in one of those places. I think I would rather be someone who travels and goes to them. And I could see, like, because, you know, what skill do I have that would be useful to that society? None, really. I'm a storyteller. I could turn up and maybe do a little, like, do some comedy or tell the story in person, like, you know.
You teach people stuff. Yeah, you have lots of skills.
I must teach them how to write comedy. Like, I don't teach them any essential life skills. I think the arts
are an important thing that are necessary to keep morale up in, especially a society like that.
All right, that's true. But I feel like I would be, my instinct would be to do that in different places, like become an itinerant, like a bit feel like the teachers.
Like a traveling, like in Middle Ages, like one of the like traveling storytellers that goes around.
Bard, you'd be a bard.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I'd do. So I wouldn't go there permanently. I'd visit. And I would have to take a small amount of stuff with me, obviously.
I'm assuming I'm being forced to go, because the question is, like, if you're going to join one of those things, I would not choose to. I'd be like, heck that.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
build,
okay.
Build a thing.
I'd want to visit, though. I'd want to go see. I'd want to go see all the cool, weird animals. I'd want to go to the High Megas and see, like, the weird kangaroo monsters and the giant we didn't even mention the giant tortoises world.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. So cool. I want to meet those guys. Like, yeah, that was awesome.
The proto-Discworlds.
And I was so I was so happy that there was more of that in this book.
That's
like,
not tortoises, that's turtles.
Well, look, the distinction between the two things is pretty arbitrary and different depending on where you are. So, you know, but I love that and I would want to go see those things.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I would be more of a, like, traveler who comes back to Earth kind of person. Like, I like having that home to come back to, and that's where I would keep all the things that I couldn't decide what to take with me. That I would probably travel light in the actual going out and seeing places. And in fact, I would probably accumulate more things for the Hearth because I would want to collect souvenirs at the places I went to.
I mean, I'm just now realizing I kind of have done this in video games. Like, you know, Fallout 3, you can have, like, houses in different places and I'll take stuff back to the one that I had to start. Same thing in Skyrim, you can have different houses and I collect books and stick them in the bookshelf in my big house. But also in No Man's Sky, the video game where you like visit all different planets, you have to build bases on different solar systems. And that's kind of similar to the Long Earth. So I think I would end up with more than one house. It would be weird. But I'd finally own a house.
Or a very homey twain. A homey twain that you could live in and move around. Like a Winnebago, but like for the king.
He'd be a
that
gray be nomad good. I'd love of the that. Skies.
No, I'd love that. That would be so cool. I'd feel like Doc Brown at the end of Back to the Future Part 3. Flying around in my cool flying train.
Complete with a cowboy hat.
With Jules and Vern. The next one is also a question from Belle, who asked, as this is a collaboration, which contemporary author would you have loved to see Terry Pratchett write with? To which me and Dionne, like, completely nerded out over Diana Wynne Jones and a very specific short story that I was delighted that we'd both read, because, like, I have no idea who else has read, like, this very specific short story in this very specific book. So have a listen. If there's one of her short stories I think about so often, and it's written for children. It's called Carol O'Neir's 100th Dream, and it's just about this young girl who has the ability to control her dreams and sort of, like, distill them afterwards. And she's basically, like, making short films or whatever, but they're immersive. And so other people can buy, like, the deluxe pillow or, like, take the elixir or whatever and experience her dream. Like, it's a film. And she is about to do her 100th one, as the title suggests. And she suddenly can't. And it turns out that actually she's not, it's a whole bunch of actors in her mind just acting it out. And they've gone on strike. They're sick of playing stereotypical characters.
She's got like seven stock characters and she just keeps recycling them. And it's a Crestomanci story. And Crestomanci comes along and immediately sees through her bullshit and is like, you've just been telling the same story over and over again. And she's like, you're the first person to notice because like everyone else has just been buying the merchandise. And it's such a good commentary on fantasy tropes and on storytelling. And that was Diana Wynne Jones. Like she wrote The Tough Guide to Fantasyland, which is just this fantastic, loving satire of fantasy as a genre. And she could do that kind of satire because she was writing from a place of like being within that genre. Like she wasn't writing that snark and satire to be mean. She was writing, she's like, I do this too. Let's interrogate this.
And Ben, you just ended up cutting out your entire answer to this question.
Well,
so
I mean, it was so much fun listening to the two of you. And I'd already in my head, while re-listening to it, I was plotting about how we'd have to do a season of this show. Or I've been literally thinking about if we want to keep going when we're done with all of Pratchett, what do we do? And I think the answer is easy. You just do another season, but it's the books of another author that we think Pratchett readers would enjoy. And clearly the first one has to be Diana Wynne Jones.
Yeah, absolutely. So I really think your answer needs to be heard, though.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's put it in. Here's me nerding out about some of my favorite other authors. Now, look, I did think about this. I did actually think Diana Wynne Jones. I'm like, I bet that's going to be Liz's answer and it's going to be real good. And then you surprised me, Diana, you had the same one. Because a lot of my favorite authors that sort of writing around the same, I'm like, I don't think their styles would mesh well together. Like, I love Douglas Adams, but I can't imagine what a collaboration between the two of them would be like. I think there's too much tension because they want to go in different directions. It wouldn't work. They're sort of just similar enough that the differences would not be compatible and complementary. So I don't think that would work. And same with quite a few. An easy one might be to say Ben Aronovich, who writes the Rivers of London series, who is clearly, he's a massive Pratchett fan. Like there's at least three or four Pratchett references in every one of his books. And I think he's got a similar sense of humor, even if he doesn't write similar jokes. I think if they collaborated on like a, maybe not like a Discworld, I think I would have liked to have seen them write something else, because Ben Aronovich's main series is it's urban fantasy, contemporary police detective in London solving mysteries. And then he sort of expanded that world out. That's good. And I love what Pratchett does, but I wonder what they would have done if they'd have tried to collaborate and come up with something together. Pratchett touched on that very seldom. Like the Johnny books and the Truckers books are about as close as he comes really to doing urban fantasy. And they're not quite that. Like they're something a bit different. You know, I feel like there's a bit of a cheat answer because Ben Aronovich reminds me a bit of Pratchett when I read him. My partner got me to read Naomi Novik's book. Is it Thorns? I think it's called.
Uprooted?
Uprooted. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, not Thorns. I'm thinking of something else. Uprooted, which I really loved. I really
have
liked
Thorns
that.
Thorns on the cover, so I can understand the connection.
But that was such a great book and such a great sort of twisting of and mixing up a lot of fairy tale things with the tropes of fantasy, something that Pratchett also is into and not funny necessarily. Like I had a few funny moments in it, but it wasn't a comedy book. And she also has done a whole series of books that I haven't read that are like a fantasy version of the Napoleonic Wars.
Is it Temeraire? Like Napoleonic Wars with dragons, I think?
Yeah. So her ideas would be quite interesting to mash up with Pratchett's style. So I think maybe she's another contemporary one.
Really interesting as well, because I think you mentioned in a previous episode of Pratchett, I think it was the Going Postal episode actually, that as much as Terry Pratchett can be great with characters, he doesn't often do romance very well. A lot of his romances feel quite forced, whereas I think Uprooted is a really well-written romance. It's got some really interesting characterization, quite different styles and different strengths. But if their styles meshed, I think that could be a really interesting story. And as you say, a really interesting melding of fairy tale and other areas.
Now I really want to read a really good comedy fantasy romance book. So,
welcome to my constant state of being.
If you know a good comedy romance fantasy book, please recommend one. You can do that on the hashtag for this episode, which is Pratchett46.
So I think that probably brings us to the end of this episode, which has been quite a wild ride of different topics.
Yes.
But I think a really fun one, like it's a good way to spend for us a Saturday morning. Don't know what time it is for you,
Yeah. And listener, I hope you enjoy the fact that this is, perhaps in some way this makes up for the fact we haven't made a Nuketown for a while, that we've just had a long, nice chat. It's nice for us to have this time to chat, but hopefully it's nice for you too to be invited to come and listen to it. That's
pretty much it,
though, I think. Is there anything we want to ask them, Liz?
Yeah, I think we'd like to keep the conversation going. So, like, we started with zombies and Ben wasn't quite sold, but I think there's some good stuff out there. So, if you have some favorite zombie books, movies, television, songs, like, I mean, there's the Cranberry song. I don't know what else. There's actually quite a lot of songs about zombies, as I found out from iZombie soundtrack. But if you have some favorite zombie stuff that you can interact with, please send us through your recommendations. We'd love that.
Yeah. All right. Yep. I'll even give it a go, maybe. I won't promise anything. I've seen one episode of The Walking Dead and I don't think I can go back. But I would love to hear if you have any particular favorite podcasts. They don't have to be about Pratchett. Although, if you have listened to any of the other Pratchett podcasts, I would love to know what you think about them. That would be cool. You know, I do want to go back eventually and listen to some of them about books we've already covered. But we'd just love to hear what your other podcast recommendations might be. No true crime for me. I'm not into that. But Liz, would you listen to a true crime podcast if someone recommended it?
Look, I'm going to be honest, probably not, because people have recommended me a lot of really good podcasts, and I've been like, yes, that sounds amazing, and I have just not gotten around to it yet. So, like, not in the near future, it will go on the list, and, like, maybe in 7 years' time, I'll be like, hey, that podcast you recommended me was amazing. But, yeah, so I just want to be upfront, like,
that's fair.
It's not because I don't want to. I appreciate recommendations, but it will take me a long time to get to them. Or I'll do it immediately. Who knows? It's chaotic, but, yeah.
I'll give it a go, though. I promise. Yeah. But until we're back next time, just stay safe out there. Look after yourself. If you can, get vaccinated.
I remember something's happened to your name in the notes.
I haven't seen it yet, but I know you're doing something cheeky and it's making me happy already.